Bill asked. Hale nodded again. There's already a black and white outside your place on Trenton Street, Rosie. She looked from Gert to Bill to Hale, dismayed and frightened all over again. The situation kept sandbagging her. She'd start to feel she was getting a handle on it, and then it would whop her flat all over again from some new direction. Why? Why? He doesn't know where I live. He can't know where I live. That's why he came to the picnic, because he thought I'd be there. Cynthia didn't tell him, did she? She says not. Hale accented the second word, but so lightly Rosie didn't catch it. Gert and Bill did, and they exchanged a look. Well, there, and Gert didn't tell him either, did you, Gert?
No, ma'am, Gert said.
Well, I like to play safe, leave it at that. I've got the guys in front of your building and backup cars, at least two in the neighborhood. I don't want to scare you all over again, but a nut who knows police procedure is a special nut. Best not to take chances.
If you think so, Rosie said in a small voice.
Miss Kinshaw, I'll send someone around to take you wherever you want to go.
Ettinger's, Gert said and stroked her robe. I'm going to make a fashion statement at the concert.
Hale grinned, then put his hand out to Bill. Mr. Steiner, good to meet you. Bill shook it.
Same here. Thanks for everything.
It's my job. He glanced from Gert to Rosie.
Good night, girls.
He looked back at Gert fast, and his face broke into a grin that knocked 15 years off his age in an instant.
Gotcha, he said, and laughed.
After a moment's thought, Gert laughed with him. On the steps outside, Bill and Gert and Rosie huddled together a little. The air was damp, and fog was drifting in off the lake. It was still thin, really no more than a nimbus around the streetlights and low-lying smoke over the wet pavement. But Rosie guessed that in another hour it would be almost thick enough to cut.
"Want to come back to DNS tonight, Rosie?" Gert asked. "They'll be coming in from the concert in another couple of hours. We could have the popcorn all made."
Rosie, who most definitely did not want to go back to DNS, turned to Bill.
If I go home, will you stay with me?
Sure, he said promptly and took her hand. It'd be a pleasure. And don't worry about the accommodations. I never saw a couch yet that I couldn't sleep on.
You haven't seen mine, she said,
knowing that her sofa wasn't going to be a problem because Bill wasn't going to be sleeping there. Her bed was a single, which meant they'd be cramped, but she thought they would still manage quite nicely. Close quarters might even add something.
Thanks again, Gert, she said.
No problem.
Gert gave her a brief, hard hug, then leaned forward and put a healthy smack on Bill's cheek. A police car came around the corner and stopped, idling.
Take care of her, guy.
I will. Gert went to her ride, then stopped to point at Bill's Harley, heeled over on its kickstand in one of the parking spaces, stenciled, Police Business Only.
And don't dump that thing in the goddamn fog.
I'll take it easy, Ma, I promise. She drew back one big fist, mock scowling, and Bill stuck out his chin with half-closed eyes and a long, suffering expression that made Rosie laugh hard. She had never expected to be laughing on the steps of a police station, but a lot of things she'd never expected had happened this year. A lot. In spite of all that had happened, Rosie enjoyed the ride back to Trenton Street almost as much as the one out to the country that morning. She clung to Bill as they cut across the city on the surface streets, the big Harley Davidson slicing smoothly through the thickening fog. The last three blocks were like riding through a dream lined with cotton. The Harley's headlight was a brilliant, cloudy cylinder, boring into the air like the beam of a flashlight cutting across a smoky room. When Bill finally turned onto Trenton Street, the buildings were little more than ghosts, and Bryant Park was a vast white blank. The black and white Hale had promised was parked in front of 897. The words, to serve and protect, were written on the side. The space in front of the car was empty. Bill swung his motorcycle into it, kicked the gear shift up into neutral with his foot, and killed the engine. "You're shivering," he said as he helped her off. She nodded and found she had to make a conscious effort to keep her teeth from chattering when she spoke.
It's more the damp than the cold. And yet, even then, She supposed she knew it was really neither. Knew on some deep level that things were not as they should be.
Well, let's get you into something dry and warm.
He stowed their helmets, locked the Harley's ignition, and dropped the key into his pocket.
Sounds like the idea of the century to me.
He took her hand and walked her down the sidewalk to the apartment building steps. As they passed the radio car, Bill raised his hand to the cop behind the wheel. The cop lifted his own hand out the window in a lazy return salute, and the streetlight gleamed on the ring he wore. His partner appeared to be sleeping. Rosie opened her purse, got out the key she would need to open the front door at this advanced hour, and turned it in the lock. She had only the faintest idea of what she was doing. Her good feelings were gone, and her earlier terror had crashed back in on her, like some huge dead iron object falling through floor after floor of an old building, an object destined to drop all the way to the basement. Her stomach was suddenly freezing, her head was throbbing, and she didn't know why. She had seen something, something, and she was so focused on her effort to think what it might have been that she did not hear the driver's door of the police car open and then chunk softly shut. She did not hear the faintly gritting footsteps on the sidewalk behind them, either. "Rosie?" Bill's voice coming out of darkness. They were in the vestibule now, but she could barely see the picture of the old geezer, she thought maybe it was Calvin Coolidge, hanging on the wall to her right, or the scrawny shape of the coat tree with its brass feet and its bristle of brass hooks standing by the stairs. Why was it so damn dark in here? Because the overhead light fixture was out, of course. That was simple. She knew a harder question, though. Why had the cop on the passenger side of the black and white been sleeping in such an uncomfortable position, with his chin way down on his chest and his cap pulled so low over his eyes that he looked like a thug in a gangster movie from the 30s? Why was he sleeping at all, for that matter, when the subject he was detailed to watch was due at any moment? Hale would be angry if he knew that, she thought distractedly. He'd want to talk to that blue suit. He'd want to talk to him right up close. Rosie, what's wrong? The footsteps behind them were hurrying now. She rolled mental footage backward like a videotape, saw Bill raising his hand to the blue suit behind the wheel of the cruiser, saying, "Hi there, good to see you," without even opening his mouth. She saw the cop raise his own hand in return, saw the gleam of the street lamp on the ring he wore. She hadn't been close enough to read the words on it, but all at once she knew what they were. She'd seen them printed backward on her own flesh many times, like an FDA stamp on a cut of meat. Service, loyalty, community. Footsteps hurried eagerly up the steps behind them. The door slammed violently shut. Someone was panting low and fast in the dark, and Rosie could smell English leather.
Norman's mind took another of those big skips while he was standing at the sink in the daughter's and sister's kitchen with his shirt off, washing fresh blood from his face and chest. The sun had been low on the horizon, glaring orange into his eyes when he raised his head and reached for the towel. He touched it, and then, without a single break that he was aware of, not so much as an eye blink, he was outside and it was dark. He was wearing the White Sox ball cap again. He was also wearing a London Fog topcoat. God knew where he had picked it up, but it was very appropriate, since a rapidly thickening fog had settled over the city. He rubbed one hand over the expensive waterproof fabric of the coat, liking the feel. An elegant item. He tried again to think of how he'd come by it, and couldn't. Had he killed someone else? Might have friends and neighbors. Might have. Anything was possible when you were on vacation. He looked up Trenton Street and saw a city police car, what they called a Charlie David car back in Norman's bailiwick, parked hubcap deep in the mist about three-quarters of the way to the next intersection. He reached into the deep left pocket of the coat, a really nice coat, somebody certainly had good taste, and touched something rubbery and crumpled. He smiled happily, like a man shaking hands with an old friend. "Zibul," he whispered, "El Toro Grande." He reached into the other pocket, not sure what he was going to find, only sure that there was something in there that he would want. He stabbed the tip of his middle finger into it, winced, and brought it carefully out. It was the chromed letter opener from his pal Maud's desk. How she screamed, he thought, and smiled as he turned the letter opener over in his hands, letting the light from the street lamps run off its blade like white liquid. Yes, she had screamed, but then she had stopped. In the end, the gals always stopped screaming, and what a relief that was. Meantime, he had a formidable problem to solve. There would be two, count 'em two, motor patrolmen in the car parked up there. They'd be armed with guns, while he was armed only with a chrome-plated letter opener. He had to take them out, and as silently as possible. A pretty problem, and one he didn't have the slightest idea how to solve. "Norm," a voice whispered. It came from his left pocket. He reached in and pulled out the mask. Its empty eye holes gazed up at him with blank, rapt attention, and the smile once more looked like a knowing sneer. In this light, the garlands of flowers decking the horns might have been clots of blood. "What?" he spoke in a low, conspiratorial whisper. "What is it?" "Have a heart attack," Zebul whispered. So that was what he did. He plodded slowly up the sidewalk toward where the cruiser was parked, plodding slower and slower as he got closer and closer. He was careful to keep his eyes down and look at the car only with his peripheral vision. They would have seen him by now, even if they were inept. They'd have to. He was the only thing moving out here. And what he wanted them to see was a man looking at his own feet, a man who was working for every step, a man who was either drunk or in trouble. His right hand was now inside his coat, massaging the left side of his chest. He could feel the blade of the letter opener, which he was holding in that hand, making little digs in his shirt. As he drew close to his objective, he staggered, just one moderate to heavy stagger, and then stopped. He stood perfectly still with his head down for a slow five count, not allowing his body to sway so much as a quarter inch to one side or the other. By now, their first assumption, that this was Mr. Jinhead making a slow way home after a few hours at the Dewdrop Inn, should be giving way to other possibilities. But he wanted them to come to him. He'd go to them if he absolutely had to, but if he had to do that, they would probably take him down. He took another three steps, not toward the cruiser now, but toward the nearest stoop. He grabbed the cold, fog-beaded iron railing, which ran up its side, and stood there panting, head still down, hoping he looked like a man who was having a heart attack, and not one with a lethal instrument hidden inside his coat. Just when he was beginning to think he had made a serious error here, the doors of the police car swung open. He heard this rather than saw it, and then he heard an even happier sound, feet hurrying toward him. "Cheese it, Rocky, da cops," he thought, and then risked a small look. He had to risk it, had to know where they were in relation to each other. If they weren't close together, he would have to stage a collapse, and that held its own ironic danger. In such a case, one of them would very likely run back to the cruiser in order to radio for an ambulance. They were a typical Charlie David team, one vet and one kid still wet behind the ears. To Norman, the rookie looked weirdly familiar, like someone he might have seen on TV. That didn't matter, though. They were close together, almost shoulder to shoulder, and that did matter. That was very nice. Cozy. "Sir," the one on the left, the older one, asked, "Sir, do you have a problem?"
"Hurts like a bastard," Norman wheezed.
"What hurts?" Still the older one. This was a crucial moment, not quite crunch time, but almost. The older cop could order his partner to radio for EMT backup at any moment, and he would be hung, but he couldn't strike just yet. They were just a tiny bit too far away. At this moment, he felt more like his old self than he had since starting on this expedition, cold and clear and totally here, aware of everything from the droplets of fog on the iron railing to a dirty gray pigeon feather lying in the gutter next to a crumpled potato chip bag. He could hear the soft, steady susurrus of the cop's breathing.
"It's in here," Norman gasped, rubbing under his coat with his right hand.
The blade of the letter opener poked through his shirt and pricked his skin, but he hardly felt it.
"It's like having a gallbladder attack, only in my chest."
"Maybe I better call an ambulance," the younger cop said, and suddenly Norman knew who the young cop reminded him of, Jerry Mathers, the kid who had played Beaver on Leave It to Beaver. He'd watched all those shows in reruns on Channel 11, some of them 5 and 6 times. The older cop didn't look a bit like the Beeves' brother Wally, though. "Hang on a sec," the older cop said, and then, incredibly, gave away the store. Let me take a look. I was a medic in the army.
Coat. Buttons,
Norman said, keeping an eye on the beeb from the corner of his eye. The older cop took another step forward. He was now standing right in front of Norman. The beeb also took a step forward. The older cop undid the top button of Norman's newfound London fog, then the second one. When he undid the third one, Norman pulled the letter opener out and plunged it into the man's throat. Blood burst out in a torrent, gushing down his uniform. In the foggy darkness, it looked like steak sauce. The beeb turned out not to be a problem. He stood, paralyzed with horror, as his partner raised his hands and beat weakly at the handle of the thing in his throat. He looked like a man trying to rid himself of some exotic leech.
Blah!
He choked.
Blah!
The beeb turned to Norman. In his shock, he seemed totally unaware that Norman had had anything to do with what had just befallen his partner, and this didn't surprise Norman at all. It was a reaction he had seen before. In his shock and surprise, the cop looked about 10 years old, now not just something like the beeb, but a dead ringer.
"Something happened to Al," the beeb said.
Norman knew something else about this young man who was about to join the city's roll of honor. Inside his head, he thought he was shouting. He really did. When what was actually coming out was only a little bitty whisper.
"Something happened to Al."
"I know," Norman said, and delivered an uppercut to the kid's chin. A dangerous punch if your opponent is dangerous, but a sixth grader could have dealt with the beeb as he was now. The blow connected squarely, knocking the young cop back into the iron railing Norman had been clutching not 30 seconds ago. The beeb wasn't as out as Norman had hoped, but his eyes had gone cloudy and vague. There was going to be no trouble here. His hat had tumbled off. The hair beneath was short, but not too short to grab. Norman got a handful and yanked the kid's head sharply down as he brought his knee up. The sound was muffled but terrific. The sound of a man with a mallet whacking a padded bag full of china. The beeb dropped like a lead bar. Norman looked around for his partner, and here was something incredible. The partner was gone. Norman wheeled around, eyes glaring, and spotted him. He was walking up the sidewalk very slowly, with his hands held out in front of him like a zombie in a fright film. Norman turned a complete circle on his heels, looking for witnesses to this comedy. He didn't see any. There was a lot of hooting and hollering drifting over from the park, teenagers running around in there playing grab-ass in the fog, but that was all right. So far his luck had been fantastic. If it held for another 45 seconds, a minute at most, he'd be home free. He ran after the older cop, who had now stopped to have another go at pulling Anna Stevenson's letter opener out of his throat. He had actually managed to get about 25 yards.
"Officer,"
Norman said in a low, peremptory voice and touched the cop's elbow. The cop turned jerkily. His eyes were glassy and bulging from their sockets, the eyes of something that belonged mounted on the wall of a hunting lodge, Norman thought. His uniform was drenched scarlet from neck to knees. Norman didn't have the slightest idea how this man could still be alive, let alone conscious. "I guess they must build cops tougher in the Midwest," he thought.
"Cop,"
the cop said urgently.
"Cop. Up."
The voice was bubbly and choked, but still amazingly strong. Norman even knew what the guy was saying. He'd made a bad mistake back there, a rookie's mistake, but Norman thought this was a man he could have been proud to serve with just the same. The letter opener handle sticking out of his throat bobbed up and down when he tried to talk in a way that reminded Norman of how the bull mask looked when he manipulated the lips from the inside.
"Yes, I'll call for backup."
Norman spoke with soft, urgent sincerity. He closed one hand on the cop's wrist. "But for now, let's get you back to the car. Come on, this way, officer." He would have used the cop's name, but didn't know what it was. The name tag on his uniform shirt was covered with blood. He couldn't very well call him Officer Al. He gave the cop's arm another gentle tug, and this time got him moving. Norman led the staggering, bleeding Charlie David cop with the letter opener in his throat back to his own black and white, expecting someone to come out of the steadily thickening fog at any moment. A man who'd gone to get a six-pack, a woman who'd been to the movies, a couple of kids on their way home from a date, maybe God Save the King, an amusement park date at Edinger's. And when that happened, he'd have to kill them, too. Once you got started killing people, it never seemed to stop. The first one spread like ripples on a pond. But no one came. There were only the disembodied voices floating across from the park. It was a miracle, really, like how Officer Al could still be on his feet even though he was bleeding like a stuck pig and had left a trail of blood behind him so wide and thick it was starting to puddle up in places. The puddles gleamed like engine oil in the fog-faded glow of the street lamps. Norman paused to pluck the Beeves' fallen hat off the steps, and when they passed the open driver's side window of the black and white, he leaned through quickly to drop it on the seat and pluck the keys from the ignition. There were a formidable number of them on the ring, so many that they couldn't lie flat against one another but stuck out like sun rays in a child's crayon drawing. But Norman had no trouble picking out the one which opened the trunk of the car. "Come on," he whispered comfortingly. "Come on, just a little further, then we can get back up rolling." He kept expecting the cop to collapse, but he didn't. He had given up on trying to pull the letter opener out of his throat, though. "Watch the curb here, officer. Whoops-a-daisy." The cop stepped off the curb. When his black uniform shoe came down in the gutter, the wound in his throat gaped open around the blade like the gill of a fish, and more blood squirted onto the collar of his shirt. "Now I'm a cop killer, too," Norman thought. He expected the idea to be devastating, but it wasn't, perhaps because a deeper, wiser part of him knew that he really hadn't killed this fine, tough police officer. Someone else had. Something. Most likely, it had been the bull. The longer Norman thought about it, the more plausible that sounded. "Hold it, officer. Here we are." The cop stopped where he was, at the back of the car. Norman used the key he had picked out to open its trunk. There was a spare tire in there, bald as a baby's ass, too, he saw. A jack, two flak vests, Kapok, not Kevlar, a pair of boots, a grease-stained copy of Penthouse, a toolkit, a police radio with half its guts spilling out. A pretty full trunk, in other words, like the trunk of every other police car he'd ever seen. But like the trunk of every other police car he'd ever seen, there was always room for one more thing. He moved the toolkit to one side and the police radio to the other, while the Beeves' partner stood swaying beside him, now completely silent, his eyes seemingly fixed on some distant point, as if he now saw the place where his new journey would begin. Norman tucked the jack behind the spare tire, then looked from the empty space to the person for whom he had created it. "Okay," he said. "Good, but I need to borrow your hat, okay?" The cop said nothing, simply swayed back and forth on his feet, but Norman's sly bag of a mother had been fond of saying, "Silence gives consent," and Norman thought it a good motto, certainly better than his father's favorite, which had been, "If they're old enough to pee, they're old enough for me." Norman took off the cop's hat and put it on his own bald head. The baseball cap went into the trunk. "Blah," said the cop, holding one smeared hand out to Norman. His eyes didn't bother. They seemed to have floated away completely. "Yes, I know, blood. That goddamn bull," Norman said, and shoved the cop into the trunk. He lay there limply, with one twitching leg still sticking out. Norman bent it at the knee, loaded it in, and slammed the trunk shut. Then he went back to the rookie. The rook was trying to sit up, although his eyes said he was still mostly unconscious. His ears were bleeding. Norman dropped to one knee, settled his hands around the young cop's throat, and began to squeeze. The cop fell backward. Norman sat on him and kept squeezing. When the Beeve had ceased all movement, Norman put his ear against the young man's chest. He heard three heartbeats from in there, random and disordered, like fish flopping on a riverbank. Norman sighed and slid his hands around the Beeve's throat again, thumbs pressing into his windpipe. "Now someone will come," he thought. "Now someone'll come for sure," but no one did. Someone called, "Yo, motherfucker!" from the white blank of Bryant Park, and there was shrill laughter, the kind only drunks and the mentally retarded can manage, but that was all. Norman bent his ear against the cop's chest again. This guy was stage dressing, and he didn't want his stage dressing coming to life at a crucial moment. This time, there was nothing ticking but the Beeve's watch. Norman picked him up, carted him around to the passenger side of the Caprice, and loaded him in. He jammed the rookie's hat down as far as he could. Black and swollen, the kid's face was now the face of a troll, and slammed the door. Now, every part of Norman's body was throbbing, but the worst pain of all had once more settled in his teeth and jaws. "Maud," he thought. That's all about Maud. Suddenly, he was very glad he couldn't remember what he had done with Maud, or to her. And of course, it really hadn't been him at all. It had been Zibul, El Toro Grande. But dear God, how everything hurt. It was as if he were being dismantled from the inside out, taken apart a bolt and a screw and a cog at a time. The Beeve was sliding slowly to the left, his dead eyes bulging out of his face like Croker marbles. No, you don't. Whoa, Nellie, Norman said, and pulled him upright again. He reached in farther and buckled the Beeve's seatbelt and harness. That did the trick. Norman stood back a little and took a critical look. He didn't think he'd done badly, all in all. The Beeve just looked conked out, catching an extra 40 or 50 winks. He leaned in the window again, careful not to disturb the Beeve's position, and pawed open the glove compartment. He expected to find a first aid kit, and he wasn't disappointed. He popped the lid, took out a dusty old bottle of Anacin, and swallowed 5 or 6. He was leaning against the side of the car, chewing them and wincing at the sharp, vinegary taste, when his mind took another of those skips. When he came back to himself, time had passed, but probably not too much. His mouth and throat were still filled with the sour taste of aspirin. He was in the vestibule of her building, snapping the light switch up and down. Nothing happened when he did it. The little room stayed dark. He'd done something to the lights then. That was good. He had one of the Charlie David cop's guns in his other hand. He was holding it by the barrel, and he had an idea he'd use the butt to hammer something. Fuses, maybe? Had he been down cellar? Maybe, but it didn't matter. The lights here didn't work, and that was enough. This was a rooming house, a nice one, but still a rooming house. It was impossible to mistake the smell of cheap food, the kind that always got cooked on a hot plate. It was a smell that seeped into the walls after a while. Nothing could get rid of it. 2 or 3 weeks from now, the characteristic sound of rooming houses in summer would be added to that smell, the low, intermingled whine of small fans set in many different windows, trying to cool rooms that would be walk-in ovens in August. She had traded her nice little house for this cramped desperation, but there was no time to puzzle over that mystery now. The question right now was how many roomers lived in this building, and how many of them would be in early on a Saturday night. How many, in other words, might be a problem? None of them will be, said the voice from the pocket of Norman's new topcoat. It was a comfy voice. None of them will be. Because what happens after doesn't matter, and that simplifies everything. If anyone gets in your way, just kill them. He turned, went out onto the stoop, and pulled the vestibule door shut behind him. He tried it and found it locked. He supposed he'd picked his way in. The lock certainly didn't look like much of a challenge, but it was mildly disquieting not to know for sure. And the lights. Why had he gone to the trouble of killing them, when she would most likely come in alone? For that matter, how did he know she wasn't in already? This second was easy. He knew she wasn't in because the bull had told him she wasn't, and he believed it. As to the first question, she might not be alone. Gertie might be with her, or, well, Zibul had said something about a boyfriend. Norman found that frankly impossible to believe, but she likes the way he kisses her, Ferd had said. Stupid. She'd never dare, but it never hurt to be safe. He started down the steps, meaning to go back to the cop car, meaning to slide behind the wheel and start waiting for her to show up, and that was when the last flip happened, and it was a flip this time, a flip and not a skip. He went up like a coin flip from the thumbnail of a referee in a pregame ritual, who to kick, who to receive, and when he came back down, he was slamming the vestibule door behind him, lunging into the darkness and locking his hands around the neck of Rose's boyfriend. He didn't know how he knew the man was her boyfriend and not just some plainclothes cop who had been charged with seeing her home safe, but who cared? He did know, and that was enough. His whole head was vibrating with outrage and fury. Had he seen this guy? She likes the way he kisses her, swapping spit with her before going in, maybe with his hands sliding down from her waist to cup her ass. He couldn't remember, didn't want to remember, didn't need to remember. I told you, the bull said. Even in its fury, its voice was perfectly lucid. I told you, didn't I? That's what her friends have taught her. Nice. Very nice. I'm going to kill you, motherfucker, he whispered into the unseen face of the man who was Rose's boyfriend and forced him back against the vestibule wall. And oh boy, if I can, if God lets me, I'm going to kill you twice. He clamped his hands around Bill Steiner's throat and began to squeeze.
Norman! Rosie screamed in the darkness. Norman, let him go! Bill's hand, which had lightly been touching the back of her arm ever since she had pulled the key out of the door, was suddenly gone. She heard stumbling footfalls, foot thuds in the darkness. Then there was a heavier bump as someone drove someone else into the vestibule wall. I'm gonna kill you, you motherfucker, came whispering out of the dark. And oh boy, if I can, if God lets me. I'm gonna kill you twice, she finished in her head before he could finish out loud. It was one of Norman's favorite threats, often yelled at the TV screen when an umpire made a call that went against Norman's beloved Yankees, or when someone cut him off in traffic. If God lets me, I'm gonna kill you twice. And now she heard a choking, gargling sound, and of course that was Bill. That was Bill in the process of having the life choked out of him by Norman's large and powerful hands. Instead of the terror Norman had always roused in her, she felt a return of the rage she'd experienced in Hale's car, and then at the police station. This time it seemed almost to engulf her. Let him alone, Norman! She screamed. Get your fucking hands off him! Shut up, you whore! Came out of the darkness, but she could hear surprise as well as anger in Norman's voice. Until now, she'd never given him a single command, not in the entire course of their marriage, or spoken to him in such a tone. And something else. There was a band of dull heat above the place where Bill had been touching her. It was the armlet, the gold armlet the woman in the chiton had given her. And in her mind, Rosie heard her snarl, "Stop your stupid sheep's whining," at her. "Quit it! I'm warning you!" she screamed at Norman, and then started toward the place from which the choking sounds and the effortful grunts were coming. She went with her hands held out before her like the hands of a blind woman, her lips drawn back from her teeth. "You're not going to choke him," she thought. "You're not. I won't let you. You should have gone away, Norman. You should have gone away and left us alone while you still could." Feet drumming helplessly against the wall just ahead of her, and she could imagine Norman holding Bill up against it, lips drawn back in his biting smile, and suddenly she was a glass woman filled with a pale red liquid, and that liquid was pure and untinctured fury.
"You shit! Didn't you hear me? Put him down, I said!"
She reached out with her left hand, which now felt as strong as an eagle's talon. The armlet was burning fiercely. She felt she should almost be able to see it, even through her sweater and the jacket Bill had loaned her, glowing like a dull ember. But there was no pain, only a kind of dangerous exhilaration. She grabbed the shoulder of the man who had beaten her for 14 years and dragged him backward. It was astoundingly easy. She squeezed his arm through the slippery, waterproof fabric of his coat, then whipped her own arm out and slung him off into the darkness. She heard the rapid rattle of his stumbling feet, then a thud, then an explosion of breaking glass. Cal Coolidge, or whoever it was in the picture over there, had taken a dive. She could hear Bill coughing and gagging. She groped for him with splayed fingers, found his shoulders, and settled her hands upon them. He was hunched over, tearing for each breath, and immediately coughing it back out. This didn't surprise her. She knew how strong Norman was. She slipped her right hand down his left arm and grasped him above the elbow. She was afraid to use her left hand, afraid she might hurt him with it. She could feel power humming in it, throbbing through it. Perhaps the most terrifying thing about the sensation was how much she liked it. "Bill," she whispered, "come on, come with me." She had to get him upstairs. She didn't know exactly why, not yet, but she did not doubt at all that when she needed to know, the knowing would come. But he didn't move. He only leaned on his hands, coughing and making those gagging noises. "Come on, goddammit," she whispered in a harsh, peremptory voice. And she had come so close to saying "you," as in "come on, goddamn you." And she knew who she sounded like. Oh, yes, indeed. Even in these desperate circumstances, she knew very well. He got moving, though, and for now that was all that mattered. Rosie led him across the vestibule with the confidence of a seeing-eye dog. He was still coughing and half-retching, but he was able to walk. "Halt!" Norman shouted from his part of the darkness. He sounded both official and desperate. "Halt or I'll shoot!" "No, you won't. That would spoil all your fun," she thought. But he did shoot.
The dead cop's .45 slanted up at the ceiling, the sound terrific in the enclosed space of the vestibule, the smell of burnt cordite sharp enough to make the eyes water. There was also a momentary shutter flash of reddish-yellow light, so bright it printed after-images on her eyes like tattoos. And she supposed that was why he had done it, to get a look at the landscape and a look at where she and Bill were in that landscape, at the foot of the stairs, in fact. Bill made a choked vomiting sound and staggered against her, sending her into the wall of the staircase. As she struggled to keep from going to her knees, she heard a rush of footsteps in the dark as Norman came for them. She lunged up the first two steps, hauling Bill with her. He paddled with his feet, trying to help. Perhaps he even did a little. As Rosie gained the second step, she flung her left hand out behind her and swept the coat tree across the foot of the stairs like a roadblock. As Norman crashed into it and began cursing, she let go of Bill, who slumped but did not fall. He was still gagging, and she sensed him bending over again, trying to get his breath back, trying to get his windpipe to work again. "Hang in," she murmured. "Just hang in there, Bill." She went up two stairs, then came back down on the other side of him, so she could use her left arm. If she was going to get him to the top of the stairs, she'd need all the power the gold armlet was putting out. She slipped her arm around his waist, and suddenly it was easy. She started to go up with him, breathing hard, and canted over to the right, like a woman counterbalancing a heavy weight, but not gasping or buckling in the knees. She had an idea she could have hauled him up a high ladder like this if that had been required. Every now and then he'd put a foot down and push, trying to help, but mostly his toes just dragged up the risers and across the carpeted stair levels. Then, as they reached the 10th step, the halfway point by her count, he started to help a little more. That was good, because there was a splintering sound from behind and below them as the coat tree snapped beneath Norman's 220 pounds. Now she could hear him coming again, not on his feet. At least it didn't sound that way, but crawling on his hands and knees. "You don't want to play with me, Rose," he panted. How far behind, she couldn't tell. And while the coat tree had slowed him down, Norman wasn't dragging a man who was hurt and only three-quarters conscious. "Stop right where you are. Quit trying to run. I only want to talk to you. Stay away!" 16, 17, 18... The light was off up here, too, and with no windows, it was as dark as a mine shaft. Then she was staggering forward, the foot that had been searching for the 19th step, finding only more level going. Apparently, there were only 18 stairs in the flight, not 20. How marvelous! They had made it to the top ahead of him. At least they had managed to do that much. "Stay away from me, Nor—" A thought struck her then, one so terrible that it froze her where she was. She sucked the last syllable of her husband's name back into herself like someone who has been punched in the stomach. Where were her keys? Had she left them dangling from the lock in the outside door? She let go of Bill so she could feel in the left-hand pocket of the leather jacket he had loaned her, and as she did, Norman's hand closed softly and persuasively around her calf, like the coil of a snake which squeezes its prey rather than poisoning it with venom. Without thinking, she kicked powerfully backward with her other foot. The sole of her sneaker connected squarely with Norman's already battered nose, and he gave voice to a sick howl of pain. This changed to a yell of surprise as he grabbed for the banister, missed it, and toppled backward into the darkened stairwell. Rosie heard a double crash as he somersaulted twice, heels overhead. "Break your neck," she screamed silently at him as her hand closed on the comforting round shape of the key ring in her jacket pocket. She had stuck it in there after all. Thank Christ, thank God, thank all the angels in the kingdom of heaven. "Break your neck. Let it in right here in the dark. Break your stinking neck. Die and leave me alone." But no. She could already hear him stirring and moving around down there. And then he was cursing her. And then there was the unmistakable marching thud of his knees as he started crawling up the stairs again, calling her all his names, cunt and dyke and whore and bitch, as he came. "I can walk," Bill said suddenly. His voice was pinched and small, but she was grateful to hear it just the same. "I can walk, Rosie. Let's get to your room. The crazy bastard is coming again." Bill started coughing, Below them, but not much below. Norman laughed. That's right, Sonny Jim. The crazy bastard is coming again. Crazy bastard is going to poke your eyeballs right out of your fucking head and then make you eat them. I wonder how they'll taste.
Stay away, Norman.
Rosie shrieked and began to guide Bill down the pitch-black hall. Her left arm was still wrapped around his midsection. With her right hand, she felt the wall, trailing her fingers along it, hunting for her door. Her left hand was a fist against Bill's side, with the only three keys she had so far accumulated in this new life, front door key, mailbox key, and room key, clutched in it.
Stay away, I'm warning you.
And from the dark behind her, still on the stairs but now very close to the top of them again, the ultimate absurdity came floating. Don't you dare warn me, you bitch. The wall notched into a door that had to be hers. She let go of Bill, picked out the key that opened this one. Unlike the one to the front door, her room key had a square head, and then jabbed it at the lock in the dark. She could no longer hear Norman. Was he on the stairs, in the hall, right behind them and reaching toward the sound of Bill's choked breathing? She found the lock, pressed her right index finger over the vertical slot of the keyway as a guide, then brought the key to it. It wouldn't go in. She could feel the tip of it pressing into the slot, but it refused to budge beyond that point. She felt panic starting to rip at her mind with busy little rat teeth. It won't go in, she panted at Bill. It's the right key, but it won't go in. Turn it over, you're probably trying it upside down.
Say, what's going on down there?
This was a new voice, farther down the hall and above them, probably on the third floor landing. It was followed by the fruitless click, click, click of a light switch.
And why are the lights out?
Stay.
Bill shouted and immediately started coughing again. He made a terrific grinding sound in his throat, trying to clear his voice.
Stay where you are. Don't come down here. Call the police.
I am the police fuckstick. A soft, strangely muffled voice said from the darkness right beside them. There was a low, thick grunt, a sound that was both eager and satisfied. Bill was jerked away from her just as she finally managed to run her room key into its slot.
No!
She screamed, flailing in the dark with her left hand. On her upper arm, the circlet was hotter than ever.
No, leave him alone! Leave him alone!
She grasped smooth leather, Bill's jacket, and then it slipped away. The horrible choking sounds, the sounds of someone whose throat is being packed tight with fine sand, began again.
Norman laughed. The sound was also muffled.
Rosie stepped toward it, arms in front of her, hands splayed and questing. She touched the side of Bill's jacket, reached over it, and touched something gruesome. It felt like dead flesh that was also somehow alive. It was lumpy, rubbery. Rubbery? He's wearing a mask, Rosie thought, some kind of mask.
And then her left hand was seized and pulled into a humid dampness that she had just time to recognize as his mouth, before his teeth clamped down on her fingers and she was bitten all the way to the bone. The pain was terrific. But once again, her reaction to it was not fear and the helpless urge to give in, to let Norman have his way as Norman had always had his way, but a rage so great it was like insanity. Instead of trying to pull free of his grinding, baleful teeth, she folded her fingers at the second knuckle, pressing the pads of her fingers against the gum line inside his front teeth. Then she set the heel of her preternaturally strong left hand against his chin and pulled. There was a strange creaking sensation under her hand, the sound a board under a man or woman's knee might make just before it snapped. She felt Norman jerk, heard him make a hollow, interrogative sound which seemed to consist solely of vowels.
Ah!
And then his lower face slid forward like a bureau drawer, coming dislocated from the hinges of his jaw. He screamed in agony, and Rosie pulled her bleeding hand free, thinking, that's what you get for biting, you bastard. Try to do it now.
She heard him go reeling backward, tracking him by his screams and the sound of his shirt sliding along the wall. Now he'll use the gun, she thought as she turned back to Bill. He leaned against the wall, a darker shape in the darkness, coughing desperately again.
Hey, you guys, come on. A joke's a joke, and enough's enough.
It was the man from upstairs, sounding petulant and put out. Only now he sounded as if he were downstairs at the far end of this hallway,
and Rosie's heart filled with foreknowing even as she twisted the key in the lock and shoved her door open. She didn't sound like herself at all when she screamed. She sounded like the other one.
"Get out of here, you fool! He'll kill you! Don't—"
The gun went off. She was looking to her left and had a nightmarish glimpse of Norman, sitting on the floor with his legs folded under him. There wasn't enough time in that flash for her to recognize what he was wearing on his head, but she did just the same. It was a bull mask with a vapidly grinning face. Blood, hers, ringed the mouth hole. She could see Norman's haunted eyes looking out at her, the eyes of a cave dweller who was about to commence some final cataclysmic battle. The complaining tenant screamed as Rosie pulled Bill in through the door and slammed it behind them. Her room was filled with shadows, and the fog had muted the glow from the street lamp which usually cast a bar of light across the floor. But the place seemed bright after the vestibule, staircase, and upstairs hall. The first thing Rosie saw was the armlet, glimmering softly in the dark. It was lying on the night table beside the base of the lamp. "I did it myself," she thought. Her amazement was so great, she felt stupid with it. "I did it all myself. Just thinking I was wearing it was enough." "Of course," another voice replied, practical, sensible. "Of course it was, because there was never power in the armlet, never. The power was always in her. The power was always in—" No, no, she wouldn't go any further down that road, absolutely not. And at that moment, her attention was diverted anyway, because Norman hit the door like a freight train. The cheap wood splintered under his weight. The door groaned on its hinges. Farther away, the upstairs neighbor, a man Rosie had never met, began to wail. "Quick, Rosie, quick. You know what to do, where to go. Rosie, call. Have to call." Bill got that far, then began coughing again, too hard to finish. She had no time to listen to such foolishness anyway. Later his ideas might be good, but now all they were apt to do was get them killed. Now her job was to take care of him, shelter him. And that meant getting him to a place where he might be safe, where they might both be safe. Rosie jerked open the closet door, expecting to see that strange other world filling it, the way it had filled her bedroom wall when she had awakened to the sound of thunder. Sunlight would come streaming out, dazzling their dark, adapted eyes. But it was only a closet, small and musty and nothing at all in it. She was wearing the only two items of clothing she had stored in there, a sweater and a pair of sneakers. Oh, yes, the picture was there, propped against the wall where she had put it. But it hadn't grown or changed or opened up or whatever it was it did. It was only a picture broken out of its frame, the sort of mediocre painting a person was apt to find in the back of a curio shop or a flea market or a pawn shop. Nothing more than that. Out in the hall, Norman rammed the door again. The crack was louder this time. A long splinter jumped out of the wood and clattered onto the floor. A few more hits would do it. Two or three might be enough. Rooming house doors were not built to withstand insanity. "It was more than just some goddamn picture," Rosie cried. "It was left there for me, and it was more than just some goddamn picture. It went into some other world. I know it did, because I've got her bracelet." She turned her head, looked at it, then ran over to the night table and snatched it up. It felt heavier than ever, and hot. "Rosie," Bill said. She could just make him out, holding his hands against his throat. She thought there was blood on his mouth. "Rosie, we have to call the—" Then he cried out as bright light washed the room, except it wasn't bright enough to be the hazy summer sunlight she had expected. It was moonlight, flooding out of the open closet and washing across the floor. She walked back to Bill with the armlet in her hand and looked in. Where the closet's back wall had been, she saw the hilltop, saw tall grasses rippling in a soft and intermittent night breeze, saw the livid lines and columns of the temple gleaming in the dark, and above all was the moon, a bright silver coin riding in a purple-black sky. She thought of the mother fox they had seen today, 1,000 years ago, looking up at such a moon. The vixen looking up as her kits slept beside her in the lee of the fallen trunk, looking raptly up at the moon with her black eyes. Bill's face was bewildered. The light on his skin lay like silver gilt. "Rosie," he said in a weak and worried voice,
His lips continued to move, but he said no more. She took his arm. Come on, Bill. We have to go. What's happening?
He was pitiful in his hurt and confusion. The expression on his face roused strange and contrasting emotions in her, wild impatience at his slow, ox-like responses, and fierce love, not quite maternal, that felt like a flame in her mind. She would protect him, yes. Yes. She would protect him unto death, if that was what it took.
Never mind what's happening, she said. Only trust me the way I trusted you to drive the motorcycle. Trust me and come. We have to go right now.
She pulled him forward with her right hand. The armlet dangled from her left like a gold donut. He resisted for a moment, and then Norman screamed and hit the door again. With a cry of fear and rage, Rosie renewed her grip on Bill's arm. She yanked him into the closet and then into the moonlit world which now lay beyond its far wall.
Things started to go seriously wrong when the bitch pushed the coat tree in front of the stairs. Norman got tangled in it somehow, or at least the London fog he liked so much did. One of the brass coat hooks somehow ran right through a buttonhole, neatest trick of the week, and another was in his pocket, like an inept pickpocket groping for a wallet. A third speared one blunt brass finger into his much-abused balls. Roaring, cursing her, he tried to lurch forward and upward. The hideous, clinging coat tree refused to let go of him, and even dragging it along behind him proved to be an impossibility. One of its claw feet had somehow hooked the newel post, clutching like a grappling hook and holding like an anchor. He had to get up there. Had to. He didn't want her locking herself and the cocksucker with her into her little bolt hole before he could get there. He had no doubt he could break the door down if he had to. He'd broken down a shitload of them in his years as a cop, some of them pretty tough old babies, but time was becoming a factor here. He didn't want to shoot her. That would be too quick and far, far too easy for the likes of his rambling Rose. But if the course he was running didn't smooth out a little, and soon, that might be the only option left to him. What a shame that would be. "Put me in, coach," the bull cried from the top coat pocket. "I'm tanned, I'm fit, I'm rested, I'm ready." Yes, that was a goddamn good idea. Norman snatched the mask out of his pocket and yanked it over his head, inhaling the smell of piss and rubber. The smells weren't bad at all when you got them together like that. In fact, they were sort of nice, sort of comforting. "Viva ze bull," he cried, and wriggled out of the top coat. He lunged forward again, gun in hand. The damned coat tree snapped under his weight, but not before trying to drive one of its goddamn hooks through his left knee. Norman hardly felt it. He was grinning and snapping his teeth savagely together inside the mask, liking the heavy click they made, a sound like colliding billiard balls. "You don't want to play with me, Rose." He tried for his feet, and the kneecap the coat tree had poked buckled under him. "Stop right where you are. Quit trying to run. I only want to talk to you." She screamed back at him, words, 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 they didn't matter. He resumed crawling, going as fast as he could and being as quiet as he could. At last, he sensed movement above him. He shot his arm out, seized her left calf, dug in with his nails. How good it felt. "Got you," he thought, savagely triumphant. "Got you, by God, got." Her foot came out of the dark with the unexpected suddenness of a buckshot-loaded blackjack, striking his nose and smashing it in a new place. The pain was terrible. It felt as if a swarm of African bees had been set loose in his head. She tore away from him, but Norman was hardly aware of this. Already he was toppling backward, groping for the banister and doing nothing but skidding his fingers briefly along its underside. He went tumbling all the way back down to the coat tree, holding onto the gun with his finger outside the trigger guard so he wouldn't blow a hole in himself. And the way things were going, that seemed all too possible. He lay in a heap for a moment, then shook his head in order to clear it, and started back up again. There was no actual skip in his thoughts this time, no complete break in consciousness, but he didn't have the slightest idea what they might have shouted at him from the top of the stairs, or what he might have shouted back. His re-traumatized nose was in front of everything, laying down a red screen of pain. He was aware that someone else was trying to horn in on the party, the fabled innocent bystander, and Rosie's little cocksucker friend was telling him to stay away. The nice thing about that was the way it located the cocksucker friend for him, no problem at all. Norman reached for the cocksucker friend, and the cocksucker friend was there. He put his hands around the cocksucker friend's neck and started choking him again. This time he meant to finish the job, only all at once he felt Rosie's hand on the side of his face, on the skin of the mask. It was like being caressed after you'd been given a shot of Novocaine. Rosie. Rosie touching him. She was here. For the first time since she'd walked out with his goddamn bank card in her purse, she was right here, and Norman lost all interest in Loverboy. He seized her hand, stuffed it through the mouth hole in the mask, and bit down as hard as he could. It was ecstasy. Only then, something happened. Something bad. Something horrible. It felt as if she had ripped his lower jaw right out of its sockets. Pain leaped up the sides of his head in polished steel darts, meeting with a bang at the crown. He screamed and reeled back from her. The bitch. Oh, the dirty bitch. What had happened to change her from the predictable thing she had been into this monster? The innocent bystander spoke up then, and Norman was pretty sure he shot him. He'd shot someone, anyway. People who screamed like that had either been shot or burned. Then, as he turned the gun toward the place where Rose and the cocksucker friend were, he heard a door slam shut. The bitch had beaten him into her room, after all. For the time being, even that was of secondary importance. His jaw had replaced his nose as the center of pain now, just as his nose had replaced his jammed knee and his outraged balls. What had she done to him? The lower half of his face felt not just torn open, but extended somehow. His teeth seemed to be satellites floating somewhere out beyond the end of his nose. "Don't be an idiot, Normie," his father whispered. "She's dislocated your jaw, that's all. You know what to do about that, so do it." "Shut up, you old queer," Norman tried to say, but with his face pulled out of shape, what emerged was, all here." He put down the gun, hooked up the sides of the mask with his thumbs. He hadn't pulled it all the way down when he put it on, which made this part of the job easier, and then gently pressed the heels of his hands against the points of his jaw. It was like touching ball bearings that had jumped out of their sockets. Steeling himself against the pain, he slid his hands farther down, tilted them up, and shoved sharply. There was pain, all right, but mostly because only one side of his jaw went back into place at first. That left the lower part of his face askew, like a dresser drawer that's been pushed in crooked. "Squint your face that way for long, Norman, and it'll freeze that way," his mother spat inside his head, the old venom he remembered so well. Norman shoved up on the right side of his face again. This time he heard a click deep inside his head as the right half of his jaw socked back into place. The whole thing felt weirdly loose, however, as if the tendons had been savagely stretched and might take quite some time to tighten up again. He had the oddest sensation that if he yawned, his jaw might plummet all the way to his belt buckle. "The mask, Normie," his father whispered. "The mask'll help if you pull it all the way down."
"That's right," the bull said.
Its voice was muffled because of the way it was rumpled up on the sides of his face, but Norman had no trouble understanding it. He pulled it down carefully, all the way this time, getting the hem well under his jawline, and it did help. It seemed to hold his face in place like an athletic supporter. "Yep," Zebul said, "just think of me as a jaw strap." Norman breathed deeply as he struggled to his feet, stuffing the cop's .45 into the waistband of his pants as he did. "All's cool," he thought. "Nobody in here but the boys. No gals allowed." It even seemed as if he could see more clearly through the eye holes of the mask now, as if his vision had been in some way boosted, undoubtedly just his imagination, but it really did feel that way, and it was a nice feeling to have, a confidence builder. He pressed himself back against the wall, then sprang forward and hit the door she and her cocksucker friend had gone through. It made his jaw waggle painfully, even inside the tight webbing of the mask, but he went again, and just as hard, with no hesitation. The door rattled in its frame, and a long sliver of wood popped out of the upper panel. He found himself wishing suddenly that Harley Bissington were here. The two of them could have taken the door in one hit, and he could have let Harley have a go at his wife while he, Norman, took care of her friend. Having a go at Rose had been one of the great unexpressed desires of Harley's life, something Norman did not understand but had read in the man's eyes every time he came over to the house. He hit the door again. On the sixth hit, or maybe it was lucky seven, he'd lost count, the lock tore free and Norman catapulted into the room. She was in here, both of them were,